Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're not talking to an artist. We're talking to an art collector. Dr. Paul Monroe. Paul, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you, Tim.
Sure. I've been to your house, and you have a large box with toothpicks in it, which I assume you spent some money on. And I have a box with toothpicks in it downstairs in my kitchen that cost me 67 cents. Can you explain to our listeners what it is? And remember, we only have 30 minutes here. What is it that makes you want to collect art? What is that about?
I have a half a million toothpicks. That's the difference between mine and yours. I saw the toothpicks. It was one of those things where it was at Reynolds Gallery, and there was this, you know, this cube of toothpicks. And you know, I think that everyone thinks the toothpicks are just incredible. I mean, you just see this cube. Nothing's holding them together. They're just sitting there.
All right, so it's just literally toothpicks in
it's
the shape of a cube.
It's about a three-foot cube of toothpicks that are just sitting there. Like, you make it by taking a pie pan and a pie cake thing, and you fill it with full of toothpicks. And then
What with toothpicks?
The form. There's a cube.
Oh, okay, so there's a cube like a box shape.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you invert it quickly. Right. And lift it up, and you're left with this cube of toothpicks. But looking at this cube, you don't know how it's sitting there. You don't know how it's how it got made.
Uh-huh.
And it's this perfect cube and just sitting there. And everybody goes up to it and touches it and sort of knocks it apart. And I can't, you know, the first time I saw it, I said, this is just amazing. It was made by a graduate student at the time. But
Who was the student?
Tara Donovan,
who's gone on
to fame and fortune.
Fame and fortune.
And makes a lot of toothpick pieces now and other cubes. But
so I assume you don't use these toothpicks for your own personal use.
We do.
Oh, you do?
When we're desperate for toothpicks. But we're not making much of a dent in the half million. And
yeah, right.
I think I can replace them.
Yes, that's true.
But it's, you know, I think what happened, like that piece, I saw it immediately and said, this is just amazing. And I think if other people opened their mind up, they would have realized it was me. I can't imagine that people couldn't walk in that gallery that day. I mean, it was just, I think everyone would respond to this piece. And it just took, a lot of people said, well, how am I going to live with a cube of a half a million toothpicks? And how am I going to clean it? Or, you know, how am I going to deal with this? And, they block it out. They say, this is too ridiculous, you know. And then 10 years later, because that was from 1993.
Was it really? 93?
Wait, was it 93? No. Maybe it
probably was.
Yeah, I think it was 93. Now everybody thinks it's totally cool. But
if
they let their mind open up then, they would have realized.
When you say let your mind open up, what does that mean to you?
You need to respond to something, but genuinely. You have to sort of filter out other people.
Uh-huh.
Not totally. You have to decide what to filter out.
Right.
But you have to filter out your skepticism. You have to filter out something that's totally new, you haven't seen before. You can't easily categorize it. Because the really good stuff is stuff you've never seen before, and it just goes, wow.
Really?
But most time you go, wow, what am I going to, you know.
How does this fit in the context?
How does this fit in my life or what I understand, or how does it fit in my house?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you can't ask it those questions. You just have to go, wow, this is incredible.
So as a collector, is it more of a emotional gut level response? Is it an intellectual? Is it a combination?
Yeah, obviously a combination. I mean, it's a combination because you have to know, I mean, you have to know something about what's out there, what people have done, what people are interested in. But then I think you have to, well, at least for me, I have to respond spontaneously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In other words, I don't go, for me, and different people are different, obviously, but I don't go and say, gee, I really like this, or rarely, I don't, I shouldn't say I never do this, but I generally don't go and say, here, this is the artist I want. I'm going to pursue this for 5 years and right. get something. I mean, it's generally, I'm familiar with a lot of people. I go and look at new things, and then I see something that is truly amazing, and I say, you know, it's informed, but it's not, but it's spontaneous too.
What's interesting about this, and what's interesting about this conversation to me, is that everyone I've talked to up until you has been on the other end. They're the people that produce it.
Right, right.
And one of the things they talk about is the intuitive process of making it, and then the stepping back away from process of looking at it intellectually based on, in many cases, years of knowledge also, but years. I mean, when we use the word intuitive, you know, what does that mean? It just means we're talking about a part of our intelligence we can't articulate.
Right.
You know, and then when we say intellectual, we're talking about art history, essentially, I guess. And surface and composition and, you know, all those kinds of things we can put a neat little box around. So it's really interesting listening to the collector's take on this, the collector's perception, because a lot of artists will sit where you're sitting right now and say, well, you know, I'm not really making it for anyone other than sort of myself, in a sense.
Right. I'm not looking at it for anyone, but it's myself too.
Right, right.
I mean, it's the same thing.
Right. What other pieces, because you have a fairly eclectic collection, don't you?
Yeah,
I mean, you're not just collecting abstract paintings, for instance.
No, yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No? It
doesn't make any sense.
Why? Why do you say that?
Well, because there's no agenda, and I'm not.
Oh, your
completing.
Collection doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, right, it doesn't make any sense. There's no agenda, no, I never say, oh, I need to complete it.
Uh-huh, right. So it's just a joy.
Yeah, it's just where I feel like going that particular time.
Uh-huh. What was the first thing you ever bought? What was the first piece you ever bought?
Oh, the first piece. I think it was a Marianne Harmon landscape.
That really?
That went well with our new house.
That's great. Looked good over the couch, huh?
It made the colors match.
I mean, how did this evolve for you? Was this as, you know, as a child you were in museums?
No, we never went to museums.
No, really?
No. I mean, you can go back real far, but I mean, the sort of collecting. I mean, I made little animated movies and college and stuff, and so I was interested. But I never took any art history classes. Never took any art classes.
Never made art yourself?
Other than these little... I made photographs, but I never took any class. I made photographs and, you know, did weird things like go out naked in the woods and make, you know, these weird nature photographs. And I made animated films, which I think are actually pretty good. But,
really?
But they were just fun.
You still have them?
Yeah, yeah.
Are they like Super 8?
They're like... yeah, like one was a pumpkin that one Halloween we carved out and just had a camera in front of a Super 8, you know, camera.
Right, right.
And made a 45-minute thing of a face appearing on a pumpkin. It made the rounds among all the stone people at that time.
Whoa, man.
Yeah, right. It was a big hit in college. And then some yarn pieces. And then I made a movie called The Creep, which is a little animated thing of a little furry animal. And the funny thing there was I sent it off to Kodak to be developed, and I got back a kid's birthday party.
Oh, no.
And, you know, it took like a weekend, like, you know, 20 hours of making this thing. And poor kid got this bizarro thing walking around, and I got this kid's birthday party. Kodak offered me another roll of film.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly right. That's exactly what they used to do. Oh, we're terribly sorry. Would you like another roll of film? And meanwhile, you're like ready to kill him.
Right. Yeah. So that was the end.
Somewhere out there is The Creep.
Yeah,
so if anybody's listening who has a copy of the Creep.
I've got the first two reels, but this is the finale. It was really good.
Okay.
But anyway, so that was just sort of hacking around. And and then we moved to Richmond, and during medical school, didn't pay too much attention about this stuff.
Yeah, right.
And then
it's a little that medical school thing can be distracting.
Yeah, it just gets in the way, you know. But then I guess what happened is it was largely through Bev Reynolds. I got interested in prints, and so
Bev Reynolds, who has
Bev Reynolds Gallery, and, you know, I was collecting prints by well-known people, and then for fun, I'd read about the people, mm-hmm. you know, before and after I bought the prints.
So that's part of it for you, the actual learning about them, reading about them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the exchange. And so what happened? What happened there was, I would look into somebody, read about them, and say, oh, I like this print, and go and get it. And then it sort of ended for me when I was trying to get Naumann's Raw War. I mm-hmm. really thought it was a cool print, and mm-hmm. I went to New York, and it's an edition of 100, and I found 10 people selling Raw War at one day, really? One Saturday in New York. And it was just a matter of, you know, what can you get the best price?
Right.
And that, it sort of lost its, you know, then it becomes pure commerce, you know.
Interesting.
You know, so.
So collecting for you really is about, finding things that you feel are distinctive or somehow distinctive right. to you.
Well, with that experience said, then prints are not really a challenge. And then at that time, the first serious piece I got was a Kiki Smith piece.
Right, right.
And
what was that? Was it a print?
No, it's two. That's a good story too.
Okay.
At the time, her dealer didn't have a place, and Bev, she did drawings of GI tracts and intestines, if you remember.
I'm thinking of army.
Oh,
like,
no.
You know, what's this, where the guys work out, you mean? Or?
Yeah. Right. No, these gastrointestinal, right. So it was sort of a semi.
Which happens to be a specialty of yours.
Yeah, right.
But we won't get into that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I said, I'm sort of interested in this person. And actually, Bev knew her dealer. And so I went by, and there were two figures, sort of stuffed girls' bodies without heads and glass hands. It was called Little Sisters. It's actually autobiographical. One of her first sister, Seton Smith, is a well-known photographer, mm-hmm. but her other sister was one of the first artists in New York to die of AIDS. So this was a real autobiographical important piece for her.
Was this what kind of piece was this? A drawing? A sculpture?
No, it's a sculpture.
It's a sculpture.
It's two cloth bodies with glass hands.
Oh, you said made
hands.
Out of glass. Okay. All right.
Yeah,
okay.
Glass hands. Mm-hmm. It's actually, all right, well, anyway.
Is it small, life size?
Yeah, it's life size.
Okay.
So a little, it was in the Whitney in her big retrospective, mm-hmm. actually. I just had it up. But nevertheless, so I bought this piece, and I came home, and it was a little more. You know, you can tell you're a collector when you spend more money than you're supposed
and
you to.
And you make in a month.
Yeah, right. You know, and it's sort of insane. So I bought this piece, and I came home and showed it to my wife, who said, I don't know, these stuffed girls with no heads, doesn't right. I don't think this is right. And so I said, oh, it'll be really good. And then she showed it to our quote decorator and said, no, you can't put two headless bodies in your living room. That's going to sort of, and this was not a difficult Kiki Smith piece, but
right.
the decorator said, no, she thought she was very knowledgeable about these things and said, no, you can't do that. Anyway, so I said, Sarah, let me just ship it here. When you see it, you'll like it. And we shipped it and Sarah said, no, I still don't like it. And then so finally, we even though I'd already bought it, she didn't know that at the time, I said, how about give it to me for my birthday? And she gave it to me for my birthday, fortunately, because right. otherwise I'd be in trouble.
So where did this thing end up? In the living room?
Yeah. No,
oh,
it
good.
Ended up. Well, then what happened was.
Or in the bathroom, right?
No, it was in the living room. And she still didn't like it. And then at that time, all of a sudden, these museums wanted to borrow it. You know, we got it in the right. house for about 3 months. And then, you know, some museum in Sweden and Netherlands, and then the Wexner wanted to borrow it. So it was gone for about 2 years, and all of a sudden she missed it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. She
really?
Said, where are the Twisted? We call them Twisted Sisters. We changed the name. Anyway, so then you know, absence makes the heart fonder or something.
Yeah, but what about that? I mean, because someone who doesn't know anything about collecting is sitting and listening to this thinking, I'm sorry, why did he want these pieces? I mean, can you articulate?
Why the sister's piece?
Yeah. I mean, what?
Oh, there was, it was this really poignant piece of these delicate glass hands. And it rung for me. It pulled on heartstrings. Not that you can articulate. See,
yeah.
I think what's important, I think if you can explain a piece, then you know, you can write down all the reasons you like something.
Right.
Then write it down. Don't make the art.
Right.
But
Or don't buy the art.
Don't buy it.
Just write it down, take it home. It's a lot cheaper.
Right. Yeah, right. And so,
so it is
it's got to be something that's I was reading this book on Kurt Vonnegut mm-hmm. on the abstraction. He was saying that art is or making art is not a sort of problem solving. Mm-hmm. What it is making up symbols that resonate mm-hmm. in other environments or other times. And that sort of this was a symbol that really resonated to me, and I think that's what you have to be attuned to. If something really resonates with you mm-hmm. in a way that you may don't understand, but it's genuine, then it probably will resonate with other people, and it'll resonate 5 years from now or 10 years from now, as opposed to.
So, do you respond more to sculpture, to painting, to
that's a good question.
To film,
I have a little of everything, but. Sculpture is easier for me.
Is it?
Yeah. And most of my mm-hmm. pieces that other people think are good are sculpture. Mm-hmm. I find painting much more difficult, but I really made an effort to try to understand and respond to painting. And
how do you mean?
Well, I
did you find that you had to bring more to painting?
Otherwise
you find yourself in that position of walking in like people who often don't have much background saying, look at that. I could have made that. I mean, I'm not saying that you were ever in that place, but did you find painting less accessible for you naturally?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And less accessible, maybe because I don't do it and I don't know the technique, and also because there's so much more of it been done, so much more of it has been done that you're really reacting to break out of the. To break out and be someone special is much harder, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, who broke out for you? Who do you like?
Oh, there's all sorts of... it's flavor of the week.
How much time we got, right?
Yeah, right. Of the painting, what I ended up doing is going to L.A. a lot, and there's some L.A. painters that are sort of...
Really?
Yeah, that's a whole nother story, but...
Well, what's the other story? Because L.A. is really very different in terms of the work than what you might find in New York.
Right. I mean, I think it's less cerebral, a little happier. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Not that they're real cerebral people out there, but it seems sort of to me less. New York, everyone's on top of each other. You're really competing, and it's much more intense, and it's a little more laid back and open-minded. Mm-hmm. And also, it's more accessible for collectors. I mean,
In terms of being able to get to it? You mean intellectually accessible?
No, I meant financially accessible.
Well, okay. You can afford to buy the stuff, right?
Right.
Good point.
Yeah, I mean, you can't.
Hard to collect if you can't buy it, you know?
Right, right. You know, New York is a very. Everyone goes to New York, and dealers are sort of.
All right, so California. So what grabbed you?
There's a young painter. There's a couple young painters that we did recently that have, and I'm trying to think of his name now.
It's okay. We got time. Don't worry about it.
I got his name. Tommy Dodge. I know him real well. I mean, I've been out to dinner with him a couple times. But Tommy Dodge is a young painter, graduated from UCLA, does these landscapes that are just absolutely stunningly beautiful. In fact, they're almost too pretty. That's the other issue, you know, if something's too pretty.
Yeah. Then it can't be serious, right?
Landscapes. Like that.
But these are abstract landscapes?
He's getting more and more abstract. Uh-huh. They're very painterly. They're really, really pretty wonderful. I'll tell you another person who is not from L.A., but Dan Walsh shows at Paula Cooper in New York and has been painting for a long time, does these really quirky – some of his paintings I don't like, but some of they're really quirky abstract painting.
Right.
And then there Brian Calvin is a figurative painting, a painter from LA that I really like, who shows in New York as well. But sculpture. Let's go back to sculpture. There's some sculpture people.
Back to that.
Yeah, there.
Are you talking California still?
Yeah, there's a guy named Evan Holloway who I think is like really going to be is really influential right now in LA, and has showed, you know, has been in the Whitney Biennial and is, you know, mm-hmm. shown in Europe a bunch. But he refused to show in New York for a long time.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't. He rides a bike around L.A.
Why? Why would he refuse to show?
He has strong social commitments not to be. I think the reason is he objects to the process.
So when we talk about the process, what we're talking about is the capitalization of art.
Right.
I mean, essentially
right.
turning it into a commodity, right?
Right. I think, you know, I think he, a lot of the dealers, he just didn't, and he's kind of a shy guy. And so he rides a bike in L.A., you know, it's really.
How do you feel about that? I mean, you are, as the collector, you are the one who ends up really putting the dollar value on the art. And yet when you talk to artists, you know, they all admit it's important to be successful, it's important to sell your work, but that's kind of the last thing
right.
that's really driving them to do it.
Right.
Had that been, they would have gone into business
because yeah, right.
they all know they're not going to make much money. What's it like to be the financial driver to this thing? I mean,
I'm not the financial driver. Let me assure you of that.
Maybe the was the wrong word.
I am
one of many.
I am like a grain of sand in the, you know, in the beach.
Right.
So,
but you are bartering cash for
right,
for
right.
art. What's that? How's that?
Is that? I don't generally barter. I mean, it
not
it
barter.
Is.
You know what I mean. You give them the cash, they give you the art. I mean,
right,
but
right. That's why. That's why it's sort of. Well, there's not a lot of skill involved with buying art. You know, there's not. You can't take a lot of credit for being
being an art buyer.
It's like going to Kmart or, you know, or Kroger. I mean, it's not hard to buy groceries.
I always wonder why they don't congratulate me when I leave Kroger's, but yeah, I guess right. I know why now.
You're an Epicurean, you know.
Right.
You
nice
drive
buy.
The, you drive
nice
the,
buy on that broccoli, Bowring.
You drive the food market.
Right.
You know,
I drive the food market, I do.
I don't see that.
It's not an equation. But what's interesting about that, it is such an equation for artists. It is so much a part of, can I let the dollar drive how I make this art? And yet
right.
when you flip it over and you've got someone who's buying it, that doesn't enter the equation, basically. It's, I have an emotional reaction to this. I have some kind of reaction.
It enters the equation. I mean, if you see something, you know, there's a lot of nice things you like, you know.
Right.
You know, gourmet food or whatever, and you say, I can't buy that bottle of wine. Or,
right.
And the same thing with art. You know, look at something and you say, gee, that's
But this
real.
Isn't the same as buying a Corvette. Or is it?
Is it the same as buying a Corvette? It's the
or,
same.
You know, or the same as buying a expensive watch or the same.
No,
as,
it's the same.
You think?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, it's a little more complicated.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I guess if you want to go, oh, I see. The artists put themselves up on a pedestal and then it's better than that. Well, I mean, there's more ideas. Yeah, I mean, there's...
You know, if this gets out, nobody's ever going to sell
right.
anything again.
Right.
It's okay. I mean, don't worry. I've only got 6 listeners. It's all right. That's all right. Right.
No, you got to... There is some difference, but I don't think you should put yourself too high on a pedestal here.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, the Corvette is a great work of art. I mean, it's pretty... You know what I mean?
Actually, I do know what you mean.
I mean,
I think there are probably a lot of people out there changing the channel right now, but I do understand what you're saying, yes.
You know, I can see lusting after a Corvette and finding the meaning in your life in the Corvette.
In a Corvette.
But
does this help you find meaning in your life?
No, it doesn't help me find meaning.
No.
It's a very interesting thing to occupy your mind and... And I read about art all the time because I find it interesting.
Uh-huh.
So it's really the icing on the cake when you come home and you can read that.
Mm-hmm.
But do I find the meaning? No, it doesn't change the meaning of life. I find it really interesting. I'll tell you, it's interesting. Years ago, Joe Faubush was the dealer who had Kiki Smith. And he was always very nice to me, and I would go to New York and I'd always go by his gallery. We'd sit down and talk for a while every time I went to New York. And the first, he had AIDS, and he was sick with AIDS, and he ultimately died of AIDS. But, you know, this went, I'd go to New York maybe 3 or 4 months, and I'd see him, and if he was sick, we would sit, we would then go out to lunch or something, and we would talk about medicine. Oh. No, we would just, that's the where the conversation with what medicine he's taking, you know, what his problems were. And then he got well. He got real sick for a period of time, and we talked about
this. I mean, let's just remind folks, that's because you have a medical degree.
Right,
I mean,
and my wife is an HIV physician.
Right.
So we would talk about that, and then when he'd feel well, I went back 3 months later, and he felt great, and the conversation just talked about art.
Interesting.
And then he got sick again. And he didn't want to talk about art. If you're sick, you really don't want to talk about art.
Yeah.
But if you feel well, you don't want to talk about medicine, right?
Right.
So you have to put it in perspective, anyway.
Yeah, but I think that says it beautifully. I mean, it really kind of does, you know, in sort of a strange, wonderful way.
Yeah.
You know, if you're sick, you don't want to talk about art.
You don't.
And you want to talk about medicine. And if you're well, you don't want to talk about medicine.
Right.
You want to talk about art. I think we've captured the entire topic. The whole thing. What piece do you have that, this is impossible to answer. Is there a piece you have that you cherish among the others?
Yeah, no. I mean, there was a fire, what would I run out with? I'd leave the toothpicks. No, I love the toothpicks, but I could make it again.
Toothpicks are great, but you could make it again.
Well, if I had the box. Yeah, and sort of, anyway, that's neither here nor there. No, there's not a one particular.
No.
There's you like everything
it's
for
like
different reasons.
It's like having a lot of kids, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good, you love them all. And,
Well, that's wonderful. Guess what? We're out of time.
Oh.
Can you believe it?
Wow.
It zooms by quickly.
I mean, another cup of coffee.
Yeah. But, you know, thanks for, sharing a perspective that, like I said, everybody else who's sat in your chair has been talking about it from terms of, what it's like to make art. And I haven't had the opportunity to talk to someone who actually collects it. And it's wonderful to hear. I want to thank you folks for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you on the radio next Friday at 12:30. And again, this is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us. And Paul, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.